Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of Theology and Sci-Fi, the podcast. I am your host, Derek V. Trout, and I'm so thankful that you have decided to join me today. We continue on with Season 2, a season of shorts where we are looking at short stories or individual TV episodes of science fiction TV shows. So today we are going to return to the printed word as we're going to look to an author that we've already looked at before. We're going to go back to looking at Ursula K. Le Guin, and we're going to look at a short story she wrote titled The Ones Who Walked Away from Omelus. This is a true short story. It won the Hugo for the best short story in 1974. It's a Hugo award-winning story. It is not very long. It did not take me very long to read it. I printed it out from finding it and getting it online. You can find it. You can get it for free if you just look for it. The Ones Who Walked Away from Omelus. And it was just like 4 pages long when I printed it out. So not very long at all, something that's easy to read, easy to get through. So if you have not read this yet, go read it. Pause this, go find it, go read it. It's not very long. You'll be able to do that, and I'll be here waiting for you when you get back because this story is worth reading. It is not a long story. It will not take you much time, and I'm telling you, pause this and go read it. It is worth it, but I know that not all of you will, so we will press on. And there's spoiler alerts, obviously, you're going to follow. And I'm going to actually read quite a bit of this story with you. But if you don't know anything about this story, The Ones Who Walked Away from Omelus, go read it and go check it out. And then you might even be able to listen to it somewhere on YouTube or something like that. Probably won't take you much time. Go read it or listen to it and then come back and we will be here. Yep, we're still here. So thank you for going and reading this or listening to it, whatever it may be. And I would love to hear what you think of this story. So again, like I said, the story won the best short story, the Hugo for the best short story in 1974. And I think it was something that was well deserved. We're not going to get much into the background of Ursula K. Le Guin and who she was. We've done that before in the first season when we looked at her novel, The Left Hand of Darkness. So we'll get right into this. Here is the opening line of the short story, The Ones Who Walked Away from Omelus. With a clamor of bells that set the swallows soaring, the festival of summer came to the city Omelus, bright towered by the sea. So right away we have this setting here that this is the festival of summer. Something good is happening here. Something good is happening in the city of Omelus. Something to be celebrated here. And then we go down a little further and we read, joyous. How is one to tell about joy? How to describe the citizens of Omelus? So it comes out, and we can see that this is a joyful city, that the residents here have something to be joyful. And then we continue reading, and they were not simple folk, you see, though they were happy. So they're happy. They enjoy things. They get along in life. It's a very peaceful city. Very peaceful city. And then we read a little further on, I do not know the rules and laws of their society, but I suspect that they were singularly few, as they did without monarchy and slavery, and so also got on without the stock exchange, the advertisement, the secret police, and the bomb. So again, you can see that historical influence that is here mentioning the bomb, 1974, Cold War, all those things going on that is there. That they can get along without the bomb. So what Le Guin is doing here, she is setting the groundwork so that we can see Omelus as a utopian city, a place that is a utopian city. And we'll see that a little bit more here as we go on. Here's what we keep reading. Yet I repeat that these were not simple folk, not dulcet shepherds, noble savages, blind utopians. They were not less complex than us. The trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by penance and socio-offense, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. If you can't lick them, join them. If it hurts, repeat it. But to praise despair is to condemn delight. To embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else. We have almost lost hold. We can no longer describe a happy man nor make any celebration of joy. How can I tell you about the people of Omelus? They were not naive and happy children, though their children were, in fact, happy. They were mature, intelligent, passionate adults whose lives were not wretched. Oh, miracle. But I wish I could describe it better. So Le Guin is really trying to convince you here that the city of Omelis is a utopian city. That's what it is, that things here are perfect, or at least they seem to be perfect here so far as we're reading along in the story. Now, what is utopian? What is that idea? The utopia is a state of things in which everything is perfect. So if you had a utopian society here, what Le Guin is making the argument for, at least for Omelis, is that a utopian city would be a happy city. Something that we wouldn't necessarily have to look at and say, well, you know, we need to embrace pain or evil makes things interesting or all these kind of strange ideas that are out there. But we can be happy. Like, happiness is not boring. Now, there is an idea, philosophy out there that we do need to embrace pain, that we have to embrace struggle, that we have to embrace hard times and not give up when we get through those. And I think that's true. And the reason those things are true, when we look at this and we say, well, maybe happiness shouldn't be the motivating factor of everything for us and in this world, and why often so many times people look for utopia, but utopia is not going to be found on this earth. Let me say that again. Utopia does not exist on this earth as it is right now. Now, why is that? It's because of the fall. God's original intention for earth was to be utopia, to be a place that is perfect, where we are in perfect relationship with God and God is in perfect relationship with us, and there's no separation of unity. There's no pain. There's no suffering. There's no death. That is God's original intention in creation. He creates things and it is good. And we have a perfect relationship with him as people when God creates. But the problem is, that's not the way that things stayed. There's a fall where sin enters into the world, and God's original intention is no longer what creation is. And that's because we have freedom, and God has enabled us with the choice so that we choose what to do, and we have a great responsibility with that. And part of that, we as people chose to sin, and sin and evil entered the world, and creation has fallen. So utopia no longer exists on this earth as it is right now. So people look for utopia, and there's some philosophies out there where we can make utopian society if we just get this right, or if we just get that right, if we just find the right people, if we just have the right economic system, if we just have the right understanding of government, if we are just able to provide this for these people, if we are can just make sure everyone has their fair amount, or so if we can just produce a place where everybody could have a job, then we could have something that's utopia. And that's what some philosophies, that's what some people want to get, is that place of utopia. But you're not going to get there on this earth as it currently is, because creation is fallen. We are fallen. And utopia does not exist on this earth as it is. Now, there's going to be a time, there is a time, friends, where God will recreate this earth and utopia will be again. For those that know and are following Jesus, we will live in utopia, a state of things in which there is perfection, in which everything is perfect. We will live in a state of things in which everything is perfect when God recreates the new heaven and the new earth. For those, again, that are following God, and for those that are not, there are consequences as well. So not everyone makes it to utopia. There is the alternative of that, a state in which there is nothing that is perfect, where things are not good, and we call that place hell. And that's a real place. So that's why, that's in part why this podcast and theology and teaching is necessary, because I don't want people to go to hell. I want you to be able to get to that place of utopia, but it can't happen in this life on this earth, because we need to wait for God to do something to be able to recreate this earth so that we can have a state of things in which everything is perfect. But that's not going to happen until God recreates the heaven and recreates heaven and earth. So if you're looking for utopia on this earth, you're just not going to find it. It's a futile search. It cannot be found as things are currently on this earth. But right now, Le Guin is trying to convince us that Omelis is utopia. Continuing on the story, she writes, "Omalis sounds, in my words, like a city in a fairy tale, long ago and far away, once upon a time. Perhaps it would be best if you imagine it as your own fancy bids, assuming it will rise to the occasion, for certainly I cannot suit you all. For instance, how about technology? I think that there would be no cars or helicopters in and above the streets. This follows from the fact that the people of Omalis are happy people. Happiness is based on just a discrimination of what is necessary, what is neither necessary nor destructive, and what is destructive. In the middle category, however, that of the unnecessary but undestructive, that of comfort, luxury, exuberance, etc., they could perfectly well have central heating, subway trains, washing machines, and all kinds of marvelous devices not yet invented here, floating light sources, fullness power, a cure for the common cold. Or they could have none of that. It doesn't matter." So she's trying here to set this as being a utopian place, but she can't do that. The narrator here in the story can't do that because each of us would have a different idea of what utopia is. So they're trying to not give you too much away. Well, here, this might be what utopia is for me, but it's not for you. So you just imagine whatever utopia is for you, that's what Omalis is. That's what it should be imagined as at this point in the story. At this point in the story, it should be imagined as that. And we can see here, at least, now, I keep saying, and maybe I should correct myself here, I keep saying Le Guin is trying to make this point. I'm not sure that this is Le Guin's idea of utopia. Just because she's writing about it doesn't mean that this is my idea of utopia. There's other things that could be going on here. There could be allegory. There could be satire. There could be, I'm going to write about something that other people may view as being utopia, even though I don't believe it myself. So when I say Le Guin, it's really just the narrator, because I don't have any names in the story. No one is named in this story. We don't have, you know, we don't have George. We don't have a Carl or a Susan or a Jane. We don't have any of those. We just have this narrator telling us this story. So really, when I'm saying Le Guin, I'm really just talking about the narrator, and don't necessarily think that these are her views. So I should probably clarify on that and probably do a little bit better with that. Another thing that I just thought of is going through this that I probably should have addressed earlier, and this has been a question by many, is the story even science fiction? The ones who walked away from Omalis. I don't know if you can make a great argument that it's science fiction. I think I can make an argument that it is, and it's close enough for me to be on this podcast, and it appeared on so many lists. It appeared on so many lists of the greatest science fiction short stories of all time that I had to go out and see what it was, and once I read it, I said, this is worth discussing. Yet another one of Le Guin's works that's worth discussing. I don't agree with Le Guin on all of her writings and philosophies and ideas. Again, I think it might be hard to find a science fiction writer that I did agree with all those things, but she makes me think, and I love the way that she writes. It's beautiful. It's just great writing, I think. So I really enjoy your stories. And when I read this, I said, this one is worth discussing because we are going to come across a moral dilemma in this story that I'm not sure science fiction really, it's hard to find somewhere else in science fiction. So for that alone, I think that this is worth discussing. But is it actually science fiction? I don't know. But we're here anyway, so let's keep going on. Here's what she writes about it. And this is where things start to get a bit strange, and there's going to be some adult themes here, so you've been forewarned. So things do get a little bit weird here in this. But I'll just continue on reading from where I left off before. "As You Like It. I incline to think that people from towns up and down the coast have been coming into Omalis during the last days before the festival on very fast little trains and double-decked trams, and that the train station of Omalis is actually the handsomest building in town, though plainer than the magnificent farmer's market. But even granted trains, I fear the Omalis, so far, strikes some of you as goody-goody. Smiles, bells, parades, horses, blah. If you so, please add an orgy. If an orgy would help, don't hesitate." So right here already, we see some sexual freedom that happens in Omalis, which I think leads to the philosophy of Omalis that we'll get to here in a minute, and I don't think it's necessarily a utopian philosophy. Well, maybe this could be a utopian philosophy to some, but we'll get back to that, because here's something else where religion comes into this that I have to read and talk about here. Let us not, however, have temples from which issue beautiful nude priests and priestesses already half in ecstasy and ready to copulate with any man or woman, lover or stranger, who desires union with the deep godhead of the blood. Although that was my first idea. But really, it would be better not to have any temples and homilies, at least not manned temples. Religion, yes. Clergy, no. Surely the beautiful nudes can just wander about offering themselves like divine souffles to the hunger of the needy and the rapture of the flesh. Let them join in the processions. Okay, so that just got weird, right? This kind of comes out of nowhere here in homilies. This idea of sexual freedom, which again, in the 1970s, this free love kind of era, kind of makes sense that this may come in here, and this being the time that it was written during. We certainly see this in some of Le Guin's other works, supporting this idea of free love and, you know, that you should have sexual freedom to do whatever you want with whoever you want, whenever you want to do it, which is clearly not the way that God has intended. We've talked about things like this before, but God's way is the best way when it comes to everything, and sex included. And the best way for that is in a monogamous marriage between one man and one woman. That is God's plan and design for marriage. Be fruitful and multiply. How do you do that? With one man and one woman. And what is the best way to do that and raise a family and to be healthy? To have a marriage, to have that covenant between two people, and also made in front of other people and made in front of God. And really, that's a covenant that should include God as well, if we're doing that properly, that covenant of marriage. So that's what God's plan is, and that's what is best. That's the way that it works, and that's the way that God wants things. But here in homilies, the narrator wants religion. Yeah, I want some religion, but I don't want the clergy. I just want to be able to have some things that I can believe, some things that are out there, maybe some statements of belief, but I don't really want anyone explaining those to me. I don't really want anyone checking up on me or keeping me accountable for those beliefs. I don't really want other people to be around me necessarily. They're believing, like, that's what it would be to have religion without clergy, to have religion without pastors, to be able to organize and to be able to encourage and be able to challenge and be able to make people go forward in the faith and telling other people about it. So this part is really strange to me. And also how you could even have religion without clergy, without some kind of leader. I suppose maybe that would be possible in some sense, if you could even call that a religion. But also this idea of like sex being mixed in here with religion. It's kind of reminds me of, you know, kind of in the ancient world, where there would be some temples where you could go and sleep with priestesses and have sex with them. And it would be a sex temple, essentially, and those kinds of things. I think that's what it is here. And it seems that's what the people of homeless like. That's what they want. That's this kind of idea of what their utopia would be. But that's not really utopia. That's miserable. That's the opposite of utopia. That's not a state of things which is in perfection. That's a state of things which is in brokenness. That is brokenness, not perfection. That is dangerous, not healthy. That there are so many problems that can come from this, that can be caused from that this is not perfection. However, continuing on, one of the things we see here, we read, "For those who like it, the faint, incessant sweetness of Druze may perfume the ways of the city. Druze, which first brings a great lightness and brilliance to the mind and limbs, and then, after some hours, a dreamy languor and wonderful visions, at last of the very arcana and inmost secrets of the universe, as well as exciting the pleasure of sex beyond all belief, and it is not habit-forming. For more modest taste, I think there ought to be beer. What else? What else belongs in the joyous city? The sense of victory, surely the celebration of courage, but as we did without clergy, let us do without soldiers. The joy building upon successful slaughter is not the right kind of joy. It will not do. It is fearful and trivial. A boundless and generous contentment, a magnanimous triumph felt not against some outer enemy, but in communion with the finest and fairest, and the souls of men everywhere, and the splendor of the world summer. This is what swells the hearts of the people of Omelas, and the victory they celebrate is that of life. I really don't think many of them need to take druze. So here again, if people want to take some drugs to feel better, then take some drugs to feel better. If some people want to drink alcohol to feel better, then take some alcohol to feel better. If people want to go sleep with the priests or priestesses, then go sleep with the priests or priestesses. I think what the utopian idea here of Omelas is, if it could be put up in one phrase, if this could be the catchphrase of the city, I think this is what it would be. If it feels good, do it. That's the utopian idea in Omelas. If it feels good, do it. But the problem with that phrase is, friends, what feels good is not always what is best for us. What feels good is not always what is best for us. We have a sinful nature within us that overpromises and underdelivers, and we think something is going to feel good, and maybe it does momentarily, whether it's something that is sexual or drugs or alcohol or even just the way that we're treating somebody or the money that we get or any of these different things may feel good, but that is a fleeting feeling. Sin may feel good. It may look good. It may smell good. It may taste good, right? That's what sin is. If sin were not that, if it did not have the appearance of goodness, we wouldn't be nearly as tempted as people as we are, but we think it's going to be good. And we think if it's going to be good, I should just do it. If it feels good, do it. That is the slogan for Omelas. At least that's what I understand the slogan of Omelas here to be. If it feels good, do it. But the problem is when things feel good, they don't feel good forever. And then we have guilt and we have shame and we have regret over those things we've done that have momentarily felt good, but not long-term been good for us. So our slogan should not be, if it feels good, do it. That's not what it should be. As people who follow Jesus, that is not our call. We have a sinful nature within us that things can feel good but are not good for us and are not the way of Jesus. Not the way of Jesus. Sin always takes us further than we ever thought we could go. So maybe we think, starting out, well, this feels good, so I'm just going to do it once. But then, well, now if I've done it once, why not do it a second time? And if I've done it twice, then does it really matter if I keep doing it? Whatever it is, whether it is sex, drugs, alcohol, stealing, lying, manipulating people, no matter what it is, if it maybe feels good and I like how that made me feel, so I'm just going to go ahead and do it, and I'm just going to do it this once, or I'm not going to do this all the time. But no, because sin always takes us further than we ever thought it would. And then we get ourselves into a mess. And those things that once felt good no longer feel good at all. And we don't love those things that we started out doing because they felt good. Now we hate those things, but we become in a condition where even though we hate those things, we cannot keep ourselves from doing it. So we end up like Paul in Romans. The things I don't want to do, I find myself doing. And the things I want to do, I can't do them. That's what Paul's writing. And who is going to help me? Who is going to save me from this, Paul writes. And then the answer is, thanks be to God, who has sent his son, Jesus Christ, who can deliver us from that, who can set us free from that cycle of sin and from that cycle of shame and from that cycle of guilt and that cycle we get into where we just took one step into it feels good, do it. And before we know it, we are drowning in that and it no longer feels good. Sin always takes you further than you thought you'd ever go. It overpromises and underdelivers, and just because something feels good does not mean that it is good for us, and it does not mean that it is the way of Jesus. One of the other things that sticks out to me here about the city of Omelas too, there's a claim in here by the narrator. One thing I know, there is none of an Omelas, is guilt. So this is a guiltless city. At least the narrator thinks it is. But I think that truly, truly the narrator knows that they're wrong. That there is guilt in Omelas, and there's a whole lot of guilt in Omelas. And maybe it's not even about these things that they think is utopian. This feels good, do it. Although I think there's some guilt about that. I think there's guilt about that because when we do things that is wrong, we feel guilt. There is something within us, there is something within the human mind that is there that makes us feel guilty when we've done something wrong, even if we are not living according, even for people who are not living according to God's standards, there is still something within them when they do something wrong that they feel some kind of way about it. They want to hide it. They don't want people to know. They feel embarrassed by it. Why? Because they knew it was wrong. Even if they're not living according to God's standards, there's still a human consciousness that God has put within all of us. There's this kind of moral code that is in our minds that when we do something wrong, we know it. And we want to hide it. We want to cover it. We feel shame. We feel guilt, whatever it may be, because it was wrong. Even if people are not living according to God's moral code, they still feel guilty. And the people of Omelas should feel guilty. These things that they are doing are not godly things. They are not godly things. But it is their idea of utopia, their idea of if it feels good, do it. But it just doesn't work that way. And that is not what leads to happiness. And that's what these people of Omelas are all about. Being happy. If it feels good, do it. That kind of mindset does not lead to happiness, period. It does not lead to happiness. It may lead to momentary happiness. It leads to fleeting happiness, but it will not lead to long-term happiness. It just won't do it. If it feels good, do it. That kind of attitude, that kind of slogan will not make you happy. It just won't. So the narrator goes on a little more and tries to convince us how great of a place that Omelas is and how people are playing music and enjoying this festival and running through fields and all these different kinds of things that seems to be great. This seems to be great. And then we read this paragraph as well. As if that little private silence were the signal, all at once a trumpet sounds from the pavilion near the starting line, imperious, melancholy, piercing. The horses rear on their slender legs, and some of them nigh in answer. Sober-faced, the young riders stroke the horses' necks and soothe them, whispering, "Quiet, quiet there, my beauty, my hope." They begin to form in ranks along the starting line. The crowds along the race course are like a field of grass and flowers in the wind. The festival of summer has begun. Do you believe? Do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. So here the narrator is asking, have I convinced you? Do you believe that this is a city of utopia? That this is a city where things are perfect and everyone would love to live here? And I am not convinced of that. I don't think this is a city of utopia. I think this is a city of brokenness and is not going to lead to long-term happiness. It's not going to lead to long-term contentment. No, it's going to lead to something else. This is not really a city of joy. It's a city of despair. But there's something else that makes Omelas the way that it is. And here's where we enter into a moral dilemma that truly is no dilemma at all. It is no dilemma at all. And here is what I'm going to read. And this is what we find out. In the basement under one of the beautiful public buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in the cellar of one of its spacious private homes, there is a room. So here the narrator doesn't even care where this room is. They just know there's a room. They don't need to know where it is. They don't want to know where it is. They don't care where it is, or at least that's what they are trying to convince you of, but they really do care. They really do care. And what's going on in this room? I think it's part of what is messing with the city of Omelas. It's not making it great. It's not making the city of Omelas great. It's making it a terrible city. But here's what we read. It has one locked door and no window. A little light seeps in dustily between the cracks and the boards. Second hand from a cobwebbed window somewhere across the cellar. In one corner of the little room, a couple of mops with stiff, clotted, foul-smelling heads stand near a rusty bucket. The floor is dirt, a little damp to the touch, as cellar dirt usually is. The room is about 3 paces long and 2 wide, a mere broom closet or disused tool room. In the room is a child. In the room, a child is sitting. It could be a boy or girl. It looks about 6, but it is actually nearly 10. First of all, here, what we see something that's very important about this child. The narrator refers to the child as it. Could be a boy, could be a girl, doesn't matter. It. We're not going to refer to this child as he. We're not going to refer to this child as she. We're going to refer to it as it, because the people of Omelas look at this child as an it. Not a person, but as an object. And they're wrong for that. Because no matter what, everybody is made in the image of God. We are created in God's image and likeness, made in the image and likeness of God. And as such, we should all be treated with dignity and respect and love and kindness and care. That's how we should treat other people who are image bearers. So no matter where you are from, no matter what your gender is, no matter what your race is, no matter where you come from, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter what you believe, you are made in the image of God. Every single person is an image bearer. They bear the image and likeness of God, and as such should be treated as that. But they are clearly not treating this child in this way. We continue reading. It is feeble-minded. Perhaps it was born defective, or perhaps it's become an imbecile through fear, malnutrition, and neglect. It picks its nose and occasionally fumbles vaguely with its toes or genitals as it sits haunched in the corner furthest from the bucket and the two mops. It is afraid of the mops. It finds them horrible. It shuts its eyes, but it knows the mops are still standing there, and the door is locked, and no one will come. The door is always locked, and nobody ever comes, except that sometimes the child has no understanding of time or intervals, but sometimes the door rattles terribly and opens, and a person or several people are there. One of them may come and kick the child and make it stand up. The others never come close, but peer in at it with frightened, disgusted eyes. The food bowl and the water jug are hastily filled. The door is locked. The eyes disappear. The people at the door never say anything, but the child who has not always lived in the tool room, the child who has not always lived in the tool room and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice sometimes speaks, "I will be good," it says. "Please let me out. I will be good." They never answer. The child used to scream for help at night and cry a good deal, but now it only makes a kind of whimpering, and it speaks less and less often. It is so thin there are no calves to its legs. Its belly protrudes. It lives on a half bowl of cornmeal and grease a day. It is naked. Its buttocks and thighs are a mass of festered sores as it sits in its own excrement continually. So here are the people of Omelis. They all know it is there, the people of Omelis. They all know this child is here in this basement, in this locked room, and is suffering. Locked around, alone in isolation and filth, only given water and food. There's no toilet. There's no sunlight. There's no people to communicate with. There's no nothing to do. There's just a child sitting and suffering in this basement. Sitting and suffering in this basement. But why? Well, let's find out. They all know it is there, all the people of Omelis. Some of them have come to see it. Others are content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why and some do not, but they all understand that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of the friendship of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skill of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest and the kindly weathers of their skies, depends wholly on this child's abominable misery. That depends wholly on this child's abominable misery. That's why the child is there. I don't know who has made this deal with them. I don't know where this deal has come from. And nobody knows, and it really truly doesn't matter. It doesn't. But what we have here is a city that believes it is living in utopia, although it is far from utopia. It's a broken city. But this just adds to its brokenness. But the people think that they are happy here, and they are healthy, and they are joyful, and they like the way that things are. And all they have to do to be in the city of their idea of utopia, all they have to do is to let one child suffer forever. There's always, my understanding is here, I don't think we're given enough information for this, but my understanding is there's always a child to suffer. So when this child has died, I think that there's another child that needs to go in and be put in this child's place, because this child has not always been there, but is there now. And it depends wholly on this child's abominable misery. That's what it depends on. And I'm not sure if it's just this child or if it would be any child. We're not given that enough information for that. But anyway, no matter what it is, there's a child here that if this one child suffer, the city of thousands gets to go living on in their idea of utopia. Now, again, not a true utopia, but it is their idea of utopia. It's what they do. And here's what we read about this. Here's what we continue on reading about some of this. This is usually explained to children when they are between 8 and 12, whenever they seem capable of understanding. And most of those who come to see the child are young people, though often enough adults come, or come back to see the child. No matter how well the matter has been explained to them, these young spectators are always shocked and sickened at the sight, as they should be, by the way. They should be shocked and sickened by this. They feel disgust, which they had thought themselves superior to. They feel anger, outrage, impotence, despite all the explanations. They would like to do something for the child, but there is nothing they can do. If the child were brought up into the sunlight out of the vile place, if it were cleaned and fed and comforted, that would be a good thing indeed. But if it were done, in that day and hour, all the prosperity and beauty and delight of Omelus would wither and be destroyed. Those are the terms. To exchange all the goodness and grace of every life in Omelus for that simple, small improvement. To throw away the happiness of thousands for the chance of happiness of one. That would be to let guilt within the walls indeed. That is some beautiful writing there. And I think the people of Omelus are already feeling some guilt about what is going on here. They look at this. They feel disgust. They want to do something about this. I think they're feeling guilt anyway. But if they were to actually go and do something about this, then they would truly show their guilt. I think they're already feeling guilt, but now they would show their guilt. So that's the exchange. All the goodness and grace of every life in Omelus for one child suffering. Friends, that is not worth it. The terms, we read on, the terms are strict and absolute. There may not even be a kind word spoken to the child. Often the young people go home in tears or in a tearless rage when they have seen the child and face this terrible paradox. They may brood over it for weeks or years, but as time goes on, they begin to realize that even if the child could be released, it would not get much good of its freedom. A little vague pleasure of warmth and food, no doubt, but little more. It is too degraded and imbecile to know any real joy. Oh, that is just terrible. That's just people of Omelus justifying this child that needs to be suffering. And I think, although I've read this story several times, it seems to me that it is this child, not just any child. And this child is here for years and maybe stays a child in a perpetual state of suffering. So it's a child who's been there for, who knows how long. Does this child ever get older? Does this child ever grow up? I don't know. We're not given information, but we see that other young people have seen this child, and then weeks or even years later, they can still be mad about it, but come to a point of justification. So is this child just in a perpetual state of being 10? Because that's what we're told the child is. Looks 6, but is actually 10. Is that, I don't know. Anyway, some questions that I hadn't thought about until this point here, so I'm just kind of working through this with you. So I don't know how that is. If they stay there, or if they can be replaced, or what has to go on. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But anyway, here's what we see is the deal here. And here's what we see has some effect on some of those in Omelus. They come, they look at this, they get mad about it, but eventually they come to a place of justification. However, this story, the title is the story, The Ones Who Walked Away from Omelus, comes from the very last paragraph that is in this story. And here's what it says. At times, one of the adolescent girls or boys who go to see the child does not go home to weep or rage, does not, in fact, go home at all. Sometimes, also a man or woman much older falls silent for a day or two and then leaves home. These people go out into the street and walk down the street alone. They keep walking and walk straight out of the city of Omelus, through the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Omelus. Each one goes alone, youth or girl, man or woman. Night falls. The traveler must pass down village streets between the houses with yellow-lit windows and on into the darkness of the fields. Each alone, they go west or north towards the mountains. They go on. They leave Omelus. They walk ahead into the darkness. and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist, but they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Omelus. And that's the way that the story ends. So some of them see here this outrage. They are so outraged. They are so guilty by what they are doing to the child that they have to leave. That they realize that this idea of utopia is not worth it for the suffering of one. But what I've, so some look at here and say, this is a moral dilemma. Do you let one child suffer or do you let thousands be happy? And I'm going to say here that I don't think this is a moral dilemma at all, because I know the God who leaves the 99 for the one. Who leaves the 99 for the one. And I think here that within my theological understanding, I know what is the right thing to do. It is to set that child free, to make everyone leave the city of Omelus and burn it to the ground, to destroy it. Part of me wants to say to destroy the people along with it, because they are the ones who have allowed this, and they are the ones who have let this go on. And it is absolutely infuriating to me that there would be a city of thousands, so many people where, yeah, we're okay with letting this one child suffer for us. Part of me wants to go in and turn the tables on them and say, well, let's go lock you in the basement then and see how, like that. That is what part of me wants to say, right? If I'm being honest with you, I'm saying go in and rescue that child and burn that city down, and whatever happens to those people happens. Part of me wants to say that. But what I would do, what I would want to do, my solution to this moral dilemma that's not much of a dilemma, would be to go in, to set the child free, and to tell the people of Omelus, in 3 days I'm burning this down. In 3 days, this city is destroyed, and no one is ever going to come back here, and no one is ever going to live here again. It is just not going to happen. Because for some, they look at it and say, well, you know, the question here for some is one life worth the life of thousands? And that's not the question that's being asked here. That's a moral dilemma. That is a moral dilemma where you can either make a choice on one hand that will save thousands of people, or on the other hand will only save one person. What do you do there? Because you have the choice to save one or to save thousands. And you can't say, if you save the thousands, you can't save the one. If you save the one, you can't save the thousands. But still, someone's going to die. Like, that is a moral dilemma. And that is a more difficult question to answer than the supposed moral dilemma of the ones who walked away from Omelus, because it's not much of a dilemma at all. The solution to this is to go in, to set that child free, to set that child free. And then whatever happens to the city may happen. But I think this child also deserves justice. So what the real thing to do is to go in there and arrest every single person in Omelus, have them have a fair trial, right? And hold them responsible for their actions and what they have done in abusing this child that they are all a part of, that they've all seen, that they all know about. And then to burn the city to the ground. Like, Omelus should be destroyed. It is not a city of utopia. It is a city of brokenness. And the answer here, what to do? What do you do with the city of Omelus? You don't just walk away. You don't just walk away because you feel guilt and you forget about it. But I think there's more of an obligation here. There's an obligation to do something. There's an obligation to go tell somebody. There's an obligation to go get somebody to come in and do something about this. But of course, that opens up another can of worms, right? Should we just let Omelus be Omelus, and whatever Omelus does, let them do? Or should we go get a city, the next city down, the city of whatever it is? I don't know. We'll say the city of Salem. We'll just say Salem because Omelus got its name when Le Guin saw a Salem, Oregon sign. So she took the O from Oregon and then spelled backwards from there. So Omelus is O Salem spelled backwards. Anyway, that's where the name's from. So let's say the people of Omelus are there. Should we just let them do what they want to do and live how they want to live, even if this one child is here suffering and going through this? Or should we go down to the next town? Should we go down to Salem and be like, hey, Salem, this is what's going on. Come get some people and let's go do something about this. But now we're getting involved in somebody else's business. Sometimes we need to get involved in other people's business. When something like this is going on, when something that is such a great injustice that is happening, if we can't do something about it ourselves, we need to go get other people to come along and to be able to do something. that can do something about it as well. So I think there's a moral obligation here, not just to walk away from Omelas, but to do something. To go set this child free, to go hold the people of Omelas accountable for their actions, and then burn this city to the ground, level it over, fill it in with concrete, do something to make sure that nothing like this will ever be built again. There's no dilemma here. There's no, could I live in the city of Omelas? No, I could not. If I knew this was going, I could not. And I couldn't just walk away. But because there's such a value that is placed on human life, the one deserves to be set free, even if it ruins the happiness of thousands. Because we serve a God, we know a God who leaves the 99 for the one. And that's what should happen here for this child in Omelas. The story just has got me fired up. It's so frustrating here that people just walk away and think that's good enough. Friends, if we just walk away from injustices in our world, it is not good enough. If we just walk away from people who are doing things wrong and people who are hurting and abusing others, if we just walk away, that is not enough. And the people here, the ones who walk away from Omelas, I get why they walk away. I don't get why they don't come back and come back with some more people and to do something about it, because that's what should be done. So here we go. We have this moral dilemma that's not really a moral dilemma in Omelas. And we've looked at this story here and what should be done and what kind of God do we serve and the importance of human life and placing it on that. And what is utopia and what really makes someone happy and sin? And we've discussed quite a bit of issues here. We've gone longer than I thought I would with this. This is, again, a pretty short story, but I think there's a lot in here to discuss. And Le Guin always gives us a lot to discuss, and I appreciate that. So we've looked at this idea here of what is utopia, this saying, if it feels good, do it. What sin really does in our lives, how it is destructive. The understanding of joy, why utopia will never exist on this earth, and what the obligation of the people should be for this child in Omelas. The responsibility is not just to walk away, but it is to go and set this child free and to hold those who have done this to this child accountable for their actions. There should be punishment for what they have done to this child. What should that punishment be? I don't know, but I fear for their punishment. I fear for them and what they have done to this child, because they all bear responsibility. And there's certainly some kind of groupthink, some kind of mob mentality here, where somebody could look at this and say, well, I can't do anything to set this child free, so I'm not going to feel as bad about it, and we're all doing it, and if we're all doing it, then am I as responsible as my next door? There's all kinds of justification that could take place. All kinds of justification for this that could take place, and we do that with things in our own lives as well, and justify them. But there is no justification for this child to have to suffer in this way, just so others can live in a version of a city that they think is utopia, but is actually truly broken. And that does it for the ones who walked away from Omelas. I truly enjoy this story, enjoy what Le Guin's writing style, and I think it's fantastic, and what she brings to the table, allowing us to discuss things so much. So what did you think of this story? What do you think should be the solution to the child in Omelas, and what should happen here? Do you think it's more of a moral dilemma than I do? I don't see much of a dilemma here. There's really no other choice to me than to go set this child free and to hold people accountable for their actions. I don't think this is not a one where I struggle with a moral dilemma. It's pretty cut and dry here what needs to be done, in my opinion. But did you like this story? Did it get you as fired up, get your blood flowing as much as it did mine? And this story makes me angry, seeing this injustice and seeing people who are either okay with it or just walk away and do nothing. And that's what happens in our world when people are okay with things and brokenness and hurt and abuse, or they just walk away. And then that just continues. And it's just a cycle that repeats over and over and over again. And we need to be cycle breakers of sin and abuse and different things that are going on in this world that are broken. We need to help break that cycle. And by doing that in this story, it's not just walking away. It's not just being okay with it, but it's going and setting the city, going and setting this child free, holding those in the city accountable, and then burning the city down. and making sure no one ever comes and lives here and does something like this again. So what do you think of this story? What do you think of the topics that we covered? I would love to hear from you. You can reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Theology and Sci-Fi. We spell sci-fi the right way around here, S-C-I-F-I. Or you can reach out to me in theologyandscifi@gmail.com. I also have a Theology and Sci-Fi Reddit account. So if you're on Reddit and want to post something and want to talk that way, feel free to reach out to me and comment that way too. So this is a story again that I enjoy it, but it makes me angry. It makes me upset. And I think maybe that's part of the point of this, that there is an obligation here that the people of Omelas have that none of them has fulfilled. Because this is not much of a moral dilemma. It is not worth it for what is happening here. So I'd love to hear from you and your thoughts and what you think about this, and can't wait to do this again next time. So thank you so much. I've truly enjoyed our time together, and I hope I hear from you, and I hope you tell a friend about this and we can continue to get some more downloads and some more likes going. So please tell a friend. I think this is a good one to discuss. I'm actually quite pleased with this, examining this story. I think it's worth it. And I'm glad that we had this opportunity to do this. So thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. We'll drop another episode again on the 28th of this month, as what we do, the 14th and the 28th, twice monthly. So watch out for that next episode that will drop the 28th of this month. Thanks again for listening. I truly do appreciate it. For Theology and Sci-Fi, I am Derek V. Trout. Their tears of the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality and to accept it. Yet it is their tears and anger, the trying of their generosity and the acceptance of their helplessness, which are perhaps the true source of the splendor of their lives. There is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free. So this is a Theology and Sci-Fi first, but my goodness, is that line that I just read there beautiful? My goodness, is that line great that we have in here that we just read? I should have probably talked about this earlier, but I love trying to get a closing line. I just couldn't click that stop button on the recorder without saying something about that. How true is that? That they, just like that child, are not free. They are bound just like that child is. They are enslaved just like that child is. Not in the same way. Obviously, the child that is there, that is kept in that room, is being enslaved and trapped in a much more terrible way than they are, but they are still also not free. They are not free. And what could they do to experience freedom? To be set free from the responsibility, from the guilt, from the shame of keeping this child there, that they too could be set free. They too could be set free, because right now they are not. They know that they, like the child, are not free. And friends, that's what happens when you live a sinful life, when you live in sin, when you're doing things that go against the way of Jesus. You are not free. Here, the children and homeless, they come to that realization. They are trapped in cycles of sin. And they are not free. And that child that is there is trapped in cycles of abuse and torture. No fault of its own. It is there and it is being abused and tortured and is not free. It is in that cycle. But the people of Omelas are in a cycle of their own choosing, a cycle of sin, a cycle of shame, a cycle of guilt. They think it's utopia, but it's really brokenness. And what a beautiful line that is, that they know that they, like the child, are not free. So friends, I ask you today, are you free? Have you allowed Jesus to come to your life to break those chains, that bondage of sin, and to be set free? I hope that's you today. We can break free from sin because of what Jesus has done. We can have that in our own lives. So today, I hope that's you. And if it's not, reach out to me and we can have more of a conversation. But I think that's a beautiful line to end on, and something that's really true, that no one in the city of Omelas is really free. Even the ones who walk away aren't really free. How do you make people free? By ending injustice for everyone. by ending injustice, by literally going and setting this child free, holding those who are responsible accountable, and by getting rid of the city. Until that happens, none of them are free. So I'm going to read that one more time, and we'll end on that. Their tears at the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality and to accept it. Yet it is their tears and anger, the trying of their generosity and the acceptance of their helplessness, which are perhaps the true source of the splendor of their lives. There is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free.